Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this week I want to talk a little bit about a very, very, very broad topic. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to give much of it justice because it's kind of huge and diffuse, but I want to talk about changing attitudes in post-war Britain towards sexuality. I particularly want to focus on Britain. I mean, you could look at a number of different countries and find throughout the 20th century, varying discourses on sexuality, but Britain seems to be synonymous, perhaps unfairly so, throughout the 20th century for a repressed attitude towards sexuality. And there appears to be a number of moments. The 60s is always focused on as the kind of the key period of change, but I wonder whether it's as fundamental as we've believed. But there had to be a number of moments in the post-war era where attitudes towards sexuality, towards the body, towards supposedly suppressed or degenerate sexualities changes. I think the big story here is about changing levels of education and affluence throughout the post-war era. One of the reasons why the 60s is seen as a fundamental era in changing attitudes and beliefs about sexuality is, of course, because of the contraceptive pill, which broke the link between heterosexual female sexual behaviour and pregnancy and motherhood. Women were unburdened with large numbers of unwanted pregnancies. And, of course, the decriminalisation of male homosexuality in 1967. But these changes don't necessarily mean that the 1960s was uniformly an era of progressive attitudes towards sexuality. Certainly at the end of the decade, there's a real backlash against this notion of permissiveness. The numbers of people actually engaging in what was described as permissive behaviour in the 1960s is comparatively few. Most people throughout the 1960s live extremely conventional lifestyles. They don't engage in sex before marriage. There's a huge percentage of young people that didn't believe in it, thought that one would, the point was to get married, to have a nuclear family, to have children, and to the idea of promiscuity was quite an anathema to large sections of the population. So a lot of the myth of the 60s is precisely that, this kind of swinging Carnaby Street notion. It was experienced by a handful of people. It was experienced by, as in all periods of where there is a kind of an intense bohemian moment, such as in Weimar Germany in the 1920s, or New York, say, in the 1970s, is a very, very small number of people that really have any experience of this. The majority of people experience it secondhand through the pages of the tabloid press of that era. If you think about, for example, the reportage on, say, for example, the Rolling Stones and the Redlands scandal, where the police raided Keith Richards' home at Redlands and found a tiny quantity of drugs and Marion Faithfull in some state of undress. This was a cause célèbre, you know, this was a sensation, but reality did not reflect the lives of ordinary people in Great Britain in the 1960s, which is probably why it was of interest to so many. One of the things that had occupied the thoughts of social planners throughout the 20th century for various reasons was the question of population, of birth rates. You find this kind of demographic obsession in the aftermath of World War One in Germany, in France, and in Great Britain. In Great Britain, it's kind of riven with class anxieties. You have the likes of T.S. Eliot, Murray Stopes, the Huxley brothers, and various Bloomsbury types, really fearing that the lower orders are going to outbreed the middle classes. You know, the middle classes may have lost the greatest and brightest number in the trenches of the First World War, and they considered that they had, you know, fewer people to lose. And one of the reasons for Marie Stopes, the contraception evangelist and sexual health campaigner, one of the reasons why she wanted contraception for working class women is because they wouldn't have so many children. And she had some number of fairly unpleasant things to say about the working classes in general, sort of a kind of the breeding like flies sort of level of language. Birth rates were going down though. By the 1930s, they reached the kind of an all time low, and this has probably got to do, as it normally does, with levels of comparative levels of affluence. Now, the 1930s, yes, are a poverty-stricken decade, but in comparative terms, most of the population is getting gradually a little bit better off over time. There are serious pockets like South Wales, the North East and Northern Ireland, and the Merseyside of deep deprivation, where those kind of statistics don't apply. But for much of the country, things are, by the mid-1930s, are gradually improving, and there is a very strong correlation, if not actual causation now, statistics show, between rising living standards and a declining birth rate. The wartime years see an increase in births, but the 1950s, again, marked by this anxiety over birth rates. And you have a period whereby there's this notion that the state invariably has the answers, and that state action can stimulate people to have more children. There is this huge uncertainty about Britain's world role after the war, and a sense that Britain is going to need lots and lots of new skilled, semi-skilled and also unskilled workers for these new industries of the future that are predicted. And throughout it all are these eugenic ideas. That is the idea that the quality of the bloodstock, the quality of the British race is in decline, and it is kind of seen as incumbent on responsible members of society, the respectable working classes, the middle classes, to have as many children as they can do, because the social ballast, the undeserving poor, are outbreeding them. It would seem that by the 1940s, that the work of Marie Stopes and other people of her generation had some effect. That women were well aware of birth control, were well aware that they could plan families, and that families are things that are planned. This is a notion that had been really quite alien to their parents' or grandparents' generations, that you time the arrival of children and decide how many you want. The Mass Observation, the social research organisation that had its heyday in the 1940s, found that women were associating smaller families with quality of life issues. which is for us in here in the 21st century kind of a fairly instinctual thought. But these were quite new concepts in the 1930s. Public health had been pioneered in the 1930s, and this had a lot to do with sexual health and maternity and reproduction and that sort of thing. In London, for example, the Pioneer Health Centre in Peckham, that was established in 1935, was part of an experiment in, not only in public and preventative health, but sexual health as well, where ordinary people, local people, paid a subscription of a shilling a week to join the clinic and had an annual health checkup, and they accessed leisure facilities, ate well, and were given sexual health advice and advice on contraception. Finsbury Health Centre opened in 1938 and was focused on particularly poor communities. So it focused on things like TB and eradicating lice in children. But there was also a lecture theatre there, and this was visited by sexual health campaigners and people who were experts in reproduction, family planning, and that kind of thing. And these ideas take root, new ideas take root gradually over time with these sorts of methods. And if reproductive rights were changing in the post-war era, so was marriage and, of course, divorce. The golden age of the pioneering of divorce laws was firstly the 1850s and then secondly the 1930s. Marie Stopes, who I mentioned before, her book Married Love put forward the idea that sexual satisfaction was actually now an integral part of marriage for women, and should be, women should be entitled to expect sexual satisfaction in marriage. And this again was not a mainstream idea in the 20s and 30s. After the war, and I think perhaps because of the war, advice, leaflets, pamphlets, booklets become increasingly more explicit. During the war, one of the great enemies of the British Army was venereal disease. Young and often unworldly and quite naive men would travel to different parts of the world and gain themselves an infection of gonorrhea or syphilis, having no idea about the things to do to protect themselves from it. And so they had to be told in pretty explicit terms what to do about this. And this culture is easily transferred to civilian life. The Marriage Guidance Council, for example, published a booklet, Sex in Marriage, in 1947, which sold over 500,000 copies over the next 20 years, which gives you a clue about its popularity and how widespread its advice was. It still existed by the 1960s in a huge kind of vacuum of knowledge about sexuality, sex and sexuality. The Marriage Guidance Council itself was established in 1938, and it reflected a new idea that marriages were partnerships, that both men and women had to contribute to them, that men couldn't simply expect their wives to be doormats for them, and that marriages weren't easy. Marriages were difficult and complicated things that had to be worked at, and there had to be perseverance and effort and all that sort of thing. I wonder if this is perhaps influenced by developments in psychology and psychoanalysis. Obviously, the 1930s are a real golden age for developments in things like family therapy, child psychology, and that kind of thing. Perhaps there is some kind of relationship there. One thing is worth saying is that there was a widespread belief, and I think there probably is a lot of truth in this, that the war had caused chaos in family life, that men had been sent overseas and been unfaithful while serving in the armies, their wives had been unfaithful while the men had been away, that men had, you know, men had come back to find either their families not there because of the bombing, or killed because of the bombing, or they had been killed at whilst away fighting, and new partners are found. So there was a widespread anxiety, particularly at an elite level, a governmental level, that these sort of disruptions to family life were going to have profound consequences for British society after the war. And obviously nobody quite knew how society would develop or change. And the there is evidence that divorce rates considerably grew in the 1940s, the second half of the 1940s, after the end of the war. Perhaps this has got less to do with infidelity than it's got to do with the trauma of war and people realising that life is short and maybe they don't never love their partner in the first place, or they don't know who this person is that they are married to. And it's got a lot to do with the greater availability of divorce. And it's only in 1969 that you actually get the kind of the big bang in divorce law, where divorce can happen by mutual consent, and that divorces don't have to be contested. It can just be an agreement. Marriage doesn't kind of wither off and die, though. You know, the marriage is only really in the 80s and 90s that marriage comes under serious sustained pressure, shall we say, and the divorce rates go up, you know, as they are now, to nearly 50%. Marriage is really quite robust in the 50s and 60s. There's a really hugely interesting chapter in Juliet Gardner's The 30s and Intimate History on working class gay life. And in it she says that in communities such as the East End of London, or in you know, mining communities in the north of England, those communities where everybody knew everybody's business, there was often a very interesting attitude towards male homosexuality. Most gay men in these communities seem to have been either in heterosexual relationships, which are a kind of a, you know, a front for gay lifestyles, or they're bisexual, or they had gay experiences in the kind of the context of their inverted commas normal lives. And much of this was quite well known. It's difficult for people in these tight-knit communities not to know one another's business. And there was a kind of a widespread tolerance to these sorts of these sorts of things, that, you know, a rather kind of frank attitude that this is what happens, this is what, you know, such and such a person does, and, you know, it obviously is not for discussion. We don't talk about these kinds of things, but everybody knows. There are essentially open secrets. I forget the chapter, but it's about in the last sort of 150 pages of the book. It's well worth a read. It's fascinating stuff. But the act of male homosexuality had been criminalised in the Criminal Law Amendments Act of 1885. But in the 1950s, we see a huge amount of anxiety and moral panic about homosexuality and other kinds of repressed or sort of prohibited sexualities, things such as prostitution or infidelity or that kind of thing. There are all sorts of anxieties that are associated with the Cambridge spies, the fact that Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean in the Cambridge spy ring were both gay. Later on, people like John Vassall, naval attaché in Moscow, who's caught in a classic KGB honey trap with a young Russian man, and therefore blackmailed for state secrets. There was this idea that, you know, somebody who is gay is therefore in some ways blackmailable or vulnerable or a security risk. And deeper than that, there was this kind of homophobic insinuations. If you're gay, well, you're not a real man, and therefore you're not really kind of sort of an integral part of the community, and therefore you're bound to do something like give state secrets to the Russians. You know, these sorts of kind of fantasies and myths, really. And interesting, quite a lot of pressure came from the United States. The United States was sharing secrets with Great Britain, and couldn't be seen to give any more information to British intelligence until they did something about their terrible homosexual problem, and this spilt out into the law, and the Home Secretary of the day, Sir David Maxwell Fife, launched a kind of like a war against homosexuality in the capital, and rigorous sentences against men for caught in acts of gross indecency with one another were enforced. I mean, the classic example is the fate of Alan Turing, the Enigma code breaker, whose actions arguably saved the country during the Second World War. Attitudes against homosexuality from the general public seem to have changed during the 1950s as a widespread sort of homophobic prejudice. But there is also a widespread sense that the state is not entitled to police the bedroom. And there is a view that if the state can police the sexual behaviour of gay men, then it can also police anybody else, and that before the 1950s there was a widespread kind of social agreement that this the state can and should perhaps do these things to ensure morality and decency, but in an era of growing affluence and growing social change, notions of what is moral and decent are also becoming highly subjective, and certainly the idea that the state is there to enforce some kind of public decency or private decency is a very contentious view. Most of the supposedly pioneering and liberal reports and reforms at the time, such as the 1952 Church of England report, The Problem of Homosexuality, still view homosexuality as inherently a bad thing. And there is this notion that there is a kind of accepted and proper sexualities and then deviant bad ones. It was the establishment of the Wolfenden Committee in 1957 which brought about the possibility of reform. So Robert Boothby, who ironically was having a very long-term affair with Harold Macmillan's wife, said that the duty of the state was to protect youth from corruption and from public indecency and nuisance. But what consenting adults do in privacy may be a moral issue between them and their maker, but it is not a legal issue between them and the state. The Sexual Offences Act 1967 was a reform. It decriminalised homosexuality, but the reforms are still quite limited because it decriminalised homosexuality between consenting adults in private, but in a private space, but the definition of what constitutes private still remained hugely ambiguous. The age of consent was fixed at 21, whereas heterosexual consent was at that time, so it's 16. There's a lot of kind of fairly unpleasant language at the time as well, which talked about protecting the youth and protecting the corruption of the youth. And this kind of thing, and there is this sort of insinuation that child sexual abuse and homosexuality might sort of be the same thing, which, of course, you know, we know that they're not. 67 Act actually makes the law against the sexual abuse of children really quite a more significant piece of legislation. It also, on the flip side, made anybody who was caught, was found guilty of gross indecency with another man aged between 16 and 21, a far more likely to serve a longer jail sentence. Prison sentences were increased from 2 to 5 years. Mm. So I would say that the 67 Act is pretty feeble evidence, in my view, that things have become, you know, that much more liberal in terms of gay rights in the 1960s. It was a fairly minor contribution. And also, the 60s, from probably, you know, 67, 68 onwards, produce a new wave of moralism. Mary Whitehouse, who I think I've mentioned before, campaigned for to clean up television from 1963 onwards. She was a Christian evangelist who believed that Britain had been modernity, and her rather eccentric view of what she thought socialism was and consumerism had warped Britain's youth, and television had been chief at the heart of this, pumping these not just, you know, these kind of perverse and rather sexualized images, and also it had simply given people lots of ideas that it was okay to sort of disrespect the royal family and that kind of thing. She's had a very broad conservative view with a small c. Mary Whitehouse launched the National Viewers and Listeners Association, but she also engaged in a religious campaign to change Britain's morality, which she becomes a laughing stock, and it's doomed to failure. In 1971, Lord Longford and Cliff Richard, of all people, performed a festival of light where they lit kind of beacons on hilltops across the land and encouraged people to join in and campaign against the growing decline in moral standards across the country. The decision by Lord Longford to investigate the issue of pornography, and in which he argued for tighter regulation of pornography, and a kind of protection of children from pornographic images, was again part of this new climate of new moralism at the end of the 1960s, an idea that permissiveness, in inverted commas, had gone too far. Anyway, I've gone too far because I've talked on for way too long, and there's an awful lot more to say. You can listen to another podcast I've done on this topic about the 1980s and HIV and Margaret Thatcher and sexual politics then. But until then, I hope you found this podcast interesting and useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.